Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. And today I am here with Tyler Gore, who is the author of My Life in Crime, Essays and Other Entertainments. Tyler, thanks for being here with me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rebecca.
Could you talk a little bit about how this collection came to be and why you put it together?
Yeah, so I had been writing these shorter essays that were personal essays, humorous essays, and publishing them in various small magazines. I had a column for a little while in a small newspaper in Long Island. So Jacob Smullyan, who is the founder of this press, Sagging Meniscus Press, was familiar with those. We knew each other, and he'd been a fan of my writing. And he said, I would love to publish a collection of these essays. And I said, that's fantastic. The thing is I'm working on an essay right now that I would love to include in there. And that's appendix that I, you know, the story about my appendectomy. And he's like, okay, you know, I sent him a couple of pages and I had thought that appendix would be a longish essay, but no longer than maybe 20 pages, like Stuff or Clinton Street Days are both about that length. And man, that essay just kept growing until it is literally 2/3 of the book. It's a novella length essay that is, you know, basically almost a book in itself. And so that's how this wound up being so weird, where there's a bunch of short essays and there's this really long essay. And Jacob is very supportive of his writers. And, you know, as this got longer and longer, I began to despair, but he was really supportive. He's like, keep going. I love what you're doing. It actually took quite a while where there was a lot of despair that I would never finish this, but he was actually great. So that's how this came about, the collection.
And we can talk about that essay towards the very end, but I will say also that there's a point where you're like, do not despair or something like this, reader. This is going to be the last sort of, you know. And so, yes, that kind of fits in with what you're saying about never like, knowing this is going to end. And I did love that. I was like, that's great. So let's start with the first essay, though, in the title essay, My Life of Crime. Can you talk a little bit about your life of crime and putting together this essay and what's going on in it?
Right. So lest your listeners, you know, have the wrong idea, my life of crime has to do with things like ring and run and ordering pizza for the neighbors. These are my crimes in the title essay. I'm not a mafia dude or an ex-con or anything like that. So the title essay, My Life of Crime, is partly about growing up in the burbs. I grew up in suburban New Jersey, just outside of the city. and about the stuff that we would do to entertain ourselves, including ordering pizzas for the neighbors.
Yes, when you were a little older than you should be ordering pizzas for the neighbors.
That's right. Yeah, because the turn of the story really has to do with when I moved back home for a little while I was, my dad was sick and I was finishing my undergraduate degree. And I think there's a line in there that when you move back home, you find yourself doing the things that you did when you last lived there. And that's what happened. Yeah.
And I really love that you sort of are thinking about like the things that you were able to do. So I laughed through a lot of this because when I was younger, yes, we didn't have caller ID or we didn't have a cell phone. Like nobody, we could block our numbers and nobody would know what they are. And it reminded me of my dad who was a teacher. And so we would have all these phone numbers of all the teachers and could prank them, right? But there's a point where that changes where you can't do that anymore.
Right.
And sometimes you forget about that when you've been used to being able to.
Right. The caller ID was like the new technology when that story takes place. And I'd just completely forgotten about that. I often wonder, do kids still make crank calls, do you think?
You know, I think they make crank calls to each other. Like they know that they're doing it. Like this is right. How I have two teenagers and yeah. I feel like that is kind of what they do. Like their crank is to kind of Rickroll, like literally still Rickroll people right. or whatever it might be. And so that they know they're doing it. So not in a way that they're going to. My son did tell me, and he, well, no one's going to hear this that would know. But they were at a soccer tournament and they had phones in the room. And so they did prank one of the other rooms and pretending they were like somebody in the hotel and it was really loud and they wanted the people to settle down. So they did prank that way. But I don't know if that, I mean, that was just because they were like, what are these telephones? We can use them.
It's the technology. Suddenly they were like, I can make an anonymous phone call.
Yes.
There it is.
I can pretend I'm an adult and get back at the other people in the room. So yes, I think sometimes that technology, yeah. It hurts us. We can't prank the way that we want to or that we used to be able to.
It's sort of sad, right? There was a God, who were those guys? The Jerky Boys used to have a whole, like they made an entire career out of prank calls.
Yes. Yes. I forgot all about those. Those are those people who you think you'll never have to think about again. And now you've just reminded me. And yeah,
there you go.
So another thing, you mentioned you grew up in New Jersey, but you are a New Yorker and you live in New York. And so throughout this, your relationship to New York, your relationship to sort of living in the city and what the city's like and what it was like sort of comes throughout this. So can you talk a little bit about that and some of the ways in which New York plays a central role in the writing that you do and the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel my life of crime in some ways is a kind of love letter to New York. I've lived here since I was in my early 20s. There was a couple of gaps, like the gaps when I was suddenly living back home for a little while. But for the most part, I've lived here all of my adult life. And you know, so the city's gone through a lot of changes. I you know, first was living in the city in, I think I first lived here in 1991 on the Lower East Side on Clinton Street. So there's an essay in the collection called Clinton Street Days that's about that period of my life where I lived on the Lower East Side in the East Village, which was very, very different from now. Like the Clinton Street that I lived on in that essay was... if you go there now, it is nothing like what it was back, you know, when I was there in the early 90s. When I was there in the early 90s, it was a largely Puerto Rican and Dominican neighborhood. It was not a particularly safe neighborhood because there was a lot of heroin going on. And it was really lively. That aspect I really liked. But when you go there today, the population has changed. I mean, there's still the old school that's still there, but, you know, there's like really nice restaurants and bars up and down the street. There was no restaurant, like there was some takeout places, but that was it. So You know, just using that street as a microcosm, like, you know, the East Village has really changed. The Lower East Side especially has changed. And the city on the whole has gotten much richer, less weirder. I think it's much harder for the kind of person that I was back then, like a young person kind of living kind of marginally, able to find a cheap place to live in a kind of dicey neighborhood. I think that is much harder today. Even in neighborhoods that are not particularly desirable, the rent is very, very high. So that's changed.
Yeah, I was going to say it made me think of during the sort of mid throughout most of the 90s, I lived in Philadelphia and we would catch the Chinatown bus from Chinatown in Philly up to Chinatown in New York so we could go out and it was like $5, right, to catch the bus and go out to clubs and do that. And I often think when I, you know, your piece made me think about this too, how afford we could do that, right? We could afford to do that. We were probably traveling and going in places we probably wouldn't do. Like at 24 and 25, we're like, we can go anywhere. It doesn't matter, right? That yeah, now we'd
Five
probably be like,
$5 to get
yeah,
to the city.
But
Yeah,
like I
from
was like the
the
chi I keep saying I'm like the Chinatown bus was the greatest thing ever. I who knows,
hub.
it probably still runs. But I'm like, and it would leave late at night, right? Like we could go out, we could get drinks, we could go to a club, we could come back. And that's not something that is as probably doable and not affordable anymore, right? I could have like $30 and make it to New York and back and, you
Yeah,
know.
I don't know what the buses go for these days with that. Like, that's become a whole thing, but they're definitely not $5. That's for sure. Like, I remember that. That was like this miracle. Like, $5. You could go to from New York, I think, to DC for like $5.
Oh yeah. Yeah, no. And so it was like it's a very diff it's try, you know, it's a very different time. And yes, it's a little seedier. Like this made me also think of I really love Patti Smith and I love Just Kids and she kind of talks about a New York in this in a similar kind of way where it was a place you could live and be kind of an artist or exist in these spaces in ways that you can't like today.
And in fact, I think like even for my generation moving here in the 90s, we would look back to that period in the 70s where Patti Smith was here and CBGBs and all of those things were going on where, you know, that was the only era where New York City's population decreased, the white flight, right? That where people were leaving for the suburbs, white people. And so in retrospect, it seems kind of exciting. Like I have all these books on punk history and stuff like that. And, you know, I was living just outside of the city as a teenager. Like the first time I ever went to CBGB's, I was probably 16 or 17. And I was coming into that city all the time, but I didn't live here. It must have been both excited. The city was quite dangerous back then, too. It must have been exciting and dangerous, you know?
One of the things that sort of it comes up in a number of these is sort of apartment living. And can you talk a you know talk a lot about sort of like this apartment you live in and like you know wanting to stay there even though you probably shouldn't stay there because it things are not getting repaired, things are not getting fixed. So can you talk a little bit about, right, that idea of because throughout a number of these, right, you talk about different way, you know, sort of those different living spaces. So can you talk a little bit about that? And
When you talk about like I know I should move, this is in appendix, which the appendix is about my appendix surgery in 2016, and I'm married, and so I'm talking about all the problems with this apartment where I'm like, you know, my wife says we should move, but I can see the Statue of Liberty out my window, so I don't want to move. I am speaking to you from that apartment. We still live here. Yeah, it's exactly like I describe it in the essay. Like, you know, by New York standards, which are horrible standards, it's a pretty decent apartment. Like, you know, it's got three bedrooms, even though one is like the size of a closet. You know, it's near the supermarket and the laundromat. But yeah, the guys who own my building, they'll never listen to this. So I'll just tell you. They are so cheap that to the point where it's like, you know, repairs, the kinds of repairs where, you know, if you fix that now, you won't have like a $1,000 disaster later on. No, they're always like, yeah, but that's $100, you know? So it's badly maintained. And everybody in this building has from time to time become involved with maintaining it because they don't. But that's New York, you know. I've always lived in walk-ups. They've always been a little bit crappy. You know, I know people who live in even really expensive and nice apartments. Apartment buildings, you just have problems. You always have leaks, neighbors, noise. But mine is particularly run down. So, yeah. And so I've lived in this apartment for quite a while. I think other apartments are described in the other essay, Clinton Street, which we were just talking about, where I just kept moving every few months, including falling behind on my rent in one apartment where I decided it was time to go.
And, you know, that reminded me, too, of like sort of my first apartment on my own and thinking about how it was so easy to be, or I don't know if I can pay this. So you send the check, but you forget one aspect of the check so that they have to send it back to you, or you accidentally send the wrong check, right? That, it's like, oh, I didn't mean that.
These are tricks I wish I knew back then. Yeah. I you know, I was really lame with just only the check is in the mail kind of thing, but not the
I forgot to sign it. Oh, I'm so sorry. I forgot to sign it. I will get, why don't you get that back to me and I'll sign it by the time I get paid. So that,
I hope you have some young listeners out there in their first apartments. Remember that. You learned it on this show.
That they can actually use checks with, like.
Oh yeah, they don't know what checks are.
No, no. I mean, I have a senior in high school, and the other day we were talking about something and I said, do you actually know how to write a check? Because you're probably going to need to at some point write a check. And he's like, I think I learned at one point, but why? Because my mom sent him a check for his birthday. And he's like, he is old. Like, what am I supposed to do with this? And I'm like, you deposit it in the bank. It still works. I promise.
Right. That's so funny. Like, what do I do with this?
I know. I'm like, it just take it. Like, it's still money. I promise. It works. But it's that, yes, that idea. So the other, you have this three international recipes that I really loved your recipe.
Oh, thank you.
I teach, one of the projects I do with students and is doing sort of multi-genre writing. And so I often have them write recipes for different things. So right?
Oh, that's great.
Yes, right. So often they're like recipes for love or recipes for, you know, surviving a zombie apocalypse or something like that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, probably recipes for meeting Taylor Swift at this point.
Right.
But can you talk a little bit about your recipes and that sort of piece?
Yeah. I love that format. That's so cool that you you assign them to your students. Like there's something really rich about the recipe format. So the three international recipes in here are, I always forget the titles of them, deep fried cheesy snacks, gloomy raisins, and a very nasty squid. And each of these was supposed to be, you know, the deep fried cheesy snacks is obviously an American specialty. Gloomy raisins is British. And a very nasty squid, of course, is French. They're just these really absurd recipes. I have long wanted to try to make them. A friend of mine wants to do that because, you know, deep fried cheesy snacks particularly sounds like, you know, it's just basically all cheese that's been microwaved and boiled, and it would be interesting to try to make it. I think the squid one is my favorite one. And that recipe is actually kind of more or less basically how you cook a squid. So, you know, I just had fun with the directions of that to put like a kind of tone in it. And the tone, I think, was a tone of despair. Like I think with the deep fried cheesy snacks, you serve with cans of beer and it serves, you know, four unemployed friends, stuff like that. Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, right? So like the deep fried cheesy snacks seemed like something I could get at like Minnesota State Fair. I was like, right. Oh yeah. And then you just have this with, well, we would probably in the Midwest, this would be something you serve with. I don't even know if ham spear exists anywhere outside the Midwest, but like, you know.
It's not one I know. Is that
exactly. It's like
a 3% beer or something?
No,
or?
It is real. It's
just
like,
cheap.
Yeah. You could get a case of that for, you know, $4 like or whatever. You know, it's one of those.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, it's like PBR before PBR got hip.
Became suddenly weirdly hip. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I used to drink old Milwaukee in college.
Yes.
Like a case for like nothing, you know.
Yes. And then if you recycled them and you got it in bottles and returned it, it'd be even cheaper. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
We did recycle them. Yes.
Yeah.
Of course, we got $0.05 back.
Well, yeah. And here, if you lived in Iowa, you got 10 cents back. So we loaded up my friend's car from Iowa and he would just bring it back to Iowa. And then we had even more beer money. So another tip for the young ones, right?
Yeah.
The college tips that they need.
Of course, it's still 10 cents. Like back then, you know.
That was a lot.
You could go to a divey bar and buy a beer for like $1.50, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So your 10 cents just doesn't go as far these days.
No, especially in New York.
Especially in New York. That is very, very true.
So you have all these essays throughout here, but like, let's talk a bit about appendix because it is longer and it is quite an interesting tale. And I got very invested in the life of your cat, Luna, and you know, and different things like that. So can you talk about sort of appendix and how appendix even came to, how this piece came to be?
So I had, routine appendix surgery in January of 2016. And the events of appendix are all just 2 weeks of my life surrounding that. With one towards the end, I jump ahead into what the future will bring, the pandemic, the election of Trump, things like that. But the rest of it is all about those 2 weeks. So it's a very, ADD essay where, I mean, that's kind of baked into it, where it keeps going on digressions all the way. Like I think you're 20 pages in before I even wind up going to the ER for my appendix surgery. You know, I'm talking about skiing and the, you know, the things that parents used to say when we were kids about Halloween candy and all of those things. And so normally, like, you know, in, say, the shorter pieces in this collection, a lot of times I'll write something and it's a subtractive process where I'll be like, you don't have enough room in a 2,500 word essay to have this long diversion. But, you know, once I really got going with appendix, I was like, you know what? Go ahead, have diversions. You know, you know, what I said, it fits in with the intestinal theme of the essay. So I go off on a lot of asides. And I think part of what I was shooting for there was within a 2 week period, I mean, 2 weeks of events. I mean, what I love about personal essays is they really allow you to get under somebody else's skin. And so I wanted to do that, to present like through this microcosm of everything revolving around these 2 weeks, you get a sense of a life, of my life. You get a sense of my marriage, our cat who's sick during the course of events here, and we're really worried that she's going to die. You get a sense of, you know, my crankiness, my lifestyle, my ADD, my wife's relative sensibility, you know, and my wife is a hospital administrator. So that complicates things in the story because I wind up eventually going to her hospital for a follow-up. And so that's kind of where it came out of, was that's how it wound up being so long, was I allowed all of those things into the essay where it's not just about this story. It branches out into all the different stories of my life.
You know, I'm a big fan, and I don't think it's done enough, of sort of endnotes or footnotes in personal essays, right? And so I love that you made that choice. I'm not as a big fan of them in academic essays all the time, but I love it because it's this way of expanding without but keeping your sort of flow going in your story. So can you talk about, I don't know if that was a conscious choice because you also do tangents. And so you have tangents and you have these footnotes. So can you talk a little bit about that and that choice?
Sure. I must have first encountered, I don't want to place this as too much of an influence because I was already doing this in correspondence back when we used to write letters. But, you know, I remember first encountering David Foster Wallace in the early 90s. You know, he had these famous essays that he wrote for Harper's that are now pretty well known. And he had a lot of that with the footnotes where I was like, you can do that, you know? And it's this way of where, as you said, you don't break up the flow of, you know, the main discussion, but you can cram in a whole aside in a footnote and they can be fun. Like, you know, I think one of the footnotes about appendicitis says, source, I Googled it. You know, another source is, I made it up. And then, you know, some of the footnotes contain more information, like on the section where I'm talking about Regina Spektor, who somehow wound up being kind of a character in that essay. I have a long footnote about that. I discovered that song in The Leftovers and why I love The Leftovers, you know. So, yeah, it's just this great device. It's really kind of this fun little extra thing, like where you can, I don't know, it's almost like a game cheat, like in a video game where you can have this little pocket universe off to the side.
Yes. And I will say, like, I really, you know, I'm like, yes, footnotes. I love them. And it works well with the tangent. So another thing in this essay that might be very random, but you talk about a Death Cab for Cutie song.
Mm-hmm.
That is on the same album of the song that I Do What You Do. So I love the song I Will Follow You Into the Dark, right?
That's true. I love that song too. It's a terrific song. Yeah.
So I was reading your essay. I was like, you are talking about your song, which I totally am blanking on the name of right now. What Sarah Said, in the way that I think about that song. And I'm like, what is this band doing?
Oh yeah, that whole album is like, yeah, I know. I actually attended a wedding last year, actually my wife's niece's wedding, where that was one of their songs, the song you mentioned, I'll Follow You Into the Dark, which I was very moved by, you know. But I understand for you, you're saying, so in the essay I said What Sarah Said, which is about, for people who don't know this song, it's about somebody witnessing somebody they love dying in a hospital. The song that you mentioned, I'll Follow You Into the Dark, it's kind of also about that. It's about somebody dying where they're saying, like, you know, if there's no, it, you know, I don't believe in heaven or hell or any of those things, but that's okay because I'll follow you into the dark. I feel moved just talking about it. It's a beautiful song.
It was. And when you talked about how, like, that song just encapsulated this imagery and using it, and I was like, that's exactly, like, I was like, damn it, that band. And I'm not a huge fan. I mean, it's not like I follow that band. They're not like on my huge playlist, but that song, I always come back to that. There's something about that song, and there's a, you know, that I'm just like, they, you know, he knows how to write this beautiful, like, story in, yeah, like, you know, 4 minutes or whatever it is. So
yeah, exactly. Like real, like, I think I call it a real tearjerker in the book. Like it's like, you know, it's a love song that has, like, the, you know, people don't usually write about that theme of like, you know, mortality and dying and accidents and things like that. And, you know, he wrote in both of those songs quite beautifully about those sentiments.
So, you know, so throughout this, you talk about sort of this entrance into sort of 2 weeks of your life, and you spent a great deal of time hopping around, visiting various hospitals, both, yes, for yourself and for your cat. And right. So there's a couple of things I'd love for you to talk about with thinking about and writing about this. So one is the fun part where you kind of like have made different names for, you know, all the people that you see, all the physicians that you see.
Right.
Based on, so can you talk a little bit about, like, writing about these people that you have come across in, you know, this experience, and how you sort of shows. It's not only for physicians, but people you sort of witness and, you know, in the waiting room and everywhere else, like coming up with these names and thinking, like writing about these people who could read your essay, right? Or could read about them, but like, it's not a distant past, right? This happened relatively in the, you know, recently in your life. So can you talk a little bit about that and some of these, and like, I really love Dr. Boy as a name for it. Like, I'm like, yeah, that's what I think about many doctors now. But yeah.
I think I started in that essay, the convention of doing that. So all the doctors have funny names. So you mentioned Dr. Boy. Dr. Boy is the doctor who comes to see me while I'm in the hospital before my surgery. And I describe him as looking like he's 15 years old, like Doogie Howser. And I think about joking about that. And then there's something about him where I sense, don't make that joke. There's something cold about him. And, you know, when I was writing the essay, the Dr. Boy almost suggested his own name, like while I was writing it, like, yeah, Dr. Boy. And once I'd given him that name, it began to be that every doctor I came across, I would think of a name to give them. Like, there's a Dr. Beeswax at my wife's hospital. My cat's veterinarian is called Dr. Katsky. So that became kind of a running joke throughout the essay. And I gave other people names too, like our super, I call him Godot because you're waiting for Godot. I think part of that has to do with the nature of writing memoir. Like, so in some of those other essays, the earlier essays, I do change people's names sometimes, or I'll change a location or some identifying feature. But in like a less wired iteration of the world than the one we live in, like now in the internet era and the social media era, you know, if you Google my name, this will come up, this essay, this book. And so when you write personal essays, the thing is that your stories, it's one thing for me to say bad things about myself or my wife with her permission, but it's another thing, like, you know, if you and I were friends hanging out and something funny happened and I wanted to write a story about Rebecca, you may not like that. And I like to have friends, and I also, I'm not a journalist and I don't want to, you know, ruin anybody's life. So part of it for me is that just change identifying details, and that gives you a little more freedom to write about all of these real people, because all those doctors are real. All the patients I encountered, my super in my building was, well, he's died, but he was a real person, you know. So that's partly where that convention came from.
So another thing with sort of the hospitals and all the visits, and you kind of hint at this in ways, is like you talk about choosing where to go based on what's going to be the busiest or what's not going to be the busiest. Or you also talk about your wife kind of getting you in to her hospital and thinking about the privilege that that is, but it's not your privilege,
right,
you know,
right.
Those kinds of, but it really does make, especially when you're in like a city like New York. I remember I broke my arm when I was in Philly and I was with a friend, and it was like weekend night. And so she's like, okay, we can't go to these hospitals because they're going to have all the trauma. They're going to have, like, this is like, she knew which emergency room we should go to, right? From knowing, you know, she's like, this is the one, here's where we're going to go, because the cops won't be bringing people there. The trauma, right? And it's, New York is kind of that same way when you're talking about. So can you talk a little bit about just navigating the hospital system for you during this time, where for yourself, and also you did it for your too, and like, yeah. So navigating multiple sort of hospital systems for yourself during this experience.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, so one thing I will say as advice to everybody, if you're going to go into a hospital, it's really good to know somebody who works in hospitals, a doctor, a nurse, an administrator, because it, you know, most of us, you know, we're not familiar with how everything works, and we try to avoid being in hospitals. So it can be very useful to have somebody there, even if they don't work at that place. So yeah, my wife's a hospital administrator. So even, you know, where I had my surgery was at NYU, which she doesn't work there. But it's useful, you know, to have her there because she just knows how things work. They're going to do this next. They're going to do this next. And then, you know, later I go to her hospital for a follow through where she actually does work. So she really was able to navigate that system in terms of, like, you know, the privilege I talk about in the book has to do with that. You know, if it's a big waiting room, a lot of times she could just introduce me as, this is my husband, to the reception, and they'll tend to bump me in, you know. So I actually wound up speaking about this subject to, I have a friend who's a doctor at Stanford, and I actually wound up speaking to it's sort of a group of doctors that meets to discuss creative writing and to read books. And I got invited in to speak about appendix because a lot of the doctors found this really fascinating from the point of view of patient experience. Like, so what you experience as a patient is opaque and weird, whereas from the point of view of the doctors and the other people who work from the hospital, this is every day, you know, for them. So anyway, yeah, there's a lot about that in the essay, about feeling not really fully understanding what's going on at any moment. But I have Natasha as my kind of Beatrice, like Dante's Beatrice, to guide me through the system.
Right. And that there are certain people who don't mind being checked into a hospital. And many of us who are like, yeah, if I can go home and sleep in my bed, that's what I want to do. Right. And there was some point where I think she was a little nervous because you were like, I'm leaving. And she's like, well, let me make sure it's okay. And the doctor was like, well, he thought you'd feel more comfortable here. And it's in just that, and not in a way like that. It makes sense because he would feel more comfortable being in the hospital, whereas you're like, no, I want my bed. Right.
Right. Because especially when I was at Natasha's hospital, you know, so because they know who I am, you know, there's this sort of thing of where they try to look after you a little more, which makes me nervous because they're doctors and I don't want doctory things done to me. So, you know, one of the things while I was there was, you know, twice they wanted to keep me overnight just because, like, from their point of view, that's a privilege. We're going to give you a bed. You can stay overnight. It's safer here. And I was like, I'm not staying here. I'm going home. I'm going to get a taxi. And yeah, the scene where I have that needle biopsy is the one where I have decided I need to get out of this place. I'm in an ER, and ER is not a safe place to be, and I want to leave. And then Natasha's like, okay, I'll talk to the doctor because he wants to keep me over. And just as you said, it was like, he was like, oh, I just thought you might like that, to stay overnight. Really?
You would like to hang out with us.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a bed.
It's like, no, I don't. When I had my two children, and it reminded me of this because the first was an emergency C-section. And so with the second, and I got really sick and I had to be in the hospital. So with the second, they were like, you want to go home? Like 2 days later, you ready to go home? I'm like, yes, I can go. I can just leave. They're right. Like, uh-huh. And I'm like, yes, I do. I want my bed.
Right. Exactly.
So I was like, I understand that.
Yeah. Nobody wants to be in a hospital.
No. You know? And so the midst, it's like, I feel too, like things compound on you because in the midst of all of this, there's also a snowstorm, right? Like right. A huge snowstorm in New York.
Right.
So you have all that going on. So it's like, how do you navigate the city? And I think one of your asides was something about letting people know that you really don't just take taxis everywhere, but like for these purposes, you need to take taxis everywhere.
Right. Yeah. Cause I throughout it, because I just had surgery, I'm taking a taxi from, you know, back from Natasha's hospital to here and all of that. And then suddenly it was like, wow, that's a lot of taxis. In real life, I ride the subway. I just want you to know that. I am a New Yorker. We ride the subway.
So, but the other thing that comes up is you have a cat, Luna, throughout this experience who is really having some traumatic experiences. So do you mind talking a little bit about your cat?
No, not at all. I'd love to talk about Luna. Yeah. So Luna had these bouts of anorexia, and in the book, post-surgery, there's a blizzard, and Luna, around the time that I got sick with appendicitis, stopped eating. So she'd done this a few times before. Normally she had a voracious appetite, but she would go into this sort of anorexic spiral where from not eating, she'd feel sicker and sicker, and then she didn't want to eat because she felt sick. And so in the course of the narrative in Appendix, you know, at one point it's been just about 10 days that she hasn't eaten, and I'm really worried that she's going to die. And Luna died recently. She did not die in the book. That's a spoiler alert, but Luna did not die back then. She died about a year ago. She was 15, and we still grieve her a lot. We have a new cat, Jasper, but Luna was very, very important to us. And so it was this thing of, I think I mentioned in there, like I call it a happy fellowship. We don't have any children. And so it was me, Natasha, and Luna, you know, moving through three different apartments. And this was kind of our family. So Luna is a major character in this essay, which was difficult. That presented some technical difficulties, cat as character.
But I do love it because I think like it really, when you mentioned earlier, it's about this sort of 2 weeks in your life that like animals are often very much a part of that, central to some of many of the decisions we make if you're a pet owner, right? Like, right. Do I go out of town? Do I leave this? Like, what do we have to get? I have two cats and a dog. And sometimes it's like, well, we have to get back for the dog, right? And right. So sometimes it's a nice excuse because it's like, I'm sorry, I got to go walk the dog, right? But it is like, but also like that does, like it matters. Like, am I going to go on this trip? How long am I going to leave the animals? So I appreciated that. We got to experience how she was part of some of that decision-making you had going on at that time.
Right. Like I talk about a reluctance to go on away on vacations because our apartment building, it's that aspect of things has improved, but you know, it used to be that we were constantly getting flooded from above us and our neighbors had once set their apartment on fire. So all of those things going away on vacation, I'd be like, I hope she's all right. She's there. You know, we always had like a cat sitter come to feed her, but the cat sitter usually sometimes would sleep here, but for the most part, often didn't. So I'd worry about overnight that this whole building would collapse or something like that.
Yes. And then hopefully the cat would find her way to you, right? Because that's what will happen. But yeah, but I think like having that pet in there. And then, so you write this, and then can you talk a little bit about your decision to, at the end, you sort of talk about the future, right? You bring us into the future and you bring us into Trump, right? You could have kind of just encapsulated this piece in the time period it was, but can you talk a little bit about that choice to kind of talk about what happened in the next sort of 4 years of the world? And
yeah, actually a magazine called Bloom Magazine, the literary one, there's another big Bloom magazine that's about flowers, I think, but published that excerpt that from that you're talking about from Appendix. So that's actually has five parts. That's the last part. And actually, in the earliest drafts of the essay, the part that you're talking about where I leap forward from 2016 to talk about the years to come was not originally in there. But I was writing it during the pandemic. So I was working on this essay, you know, it was written in different sections that were blocked out. And a big theme of Appendix is growing older and mortality. And the theme of mortality runs through the whole essay. And then suddenly we were in New York during the pandemic. We stayed in New York because Natasha's a hospital administrator, so we had to stay. And death is everywhere suddenly. So I had to write about that. I had to write about what was happening that year. And I think originally I'd meant to just write about the election of Trump because that happened at the end of 2016. But that just led into the world that we were living in 2020. where a lot of the things in the book I talk about, like, I'm kind of afraid to go skiing, I never ride a bicycle, all of those things. And part of that section about talking about all the things that we did in 2020 was about Natasha and I began riding bicycles. I even began riding a moped for a little while. All of those things, suddenly it just felt like, well, you may die before this year is done. And so the fear of doing things began to seem like irrelevant in some ways about, you know, you only have this time to live. So I actually really love that section. And thank you for bringing it up, that 2020 section, where that's, you know, my take on what that year was like, because there was a lot of kind of magical things about that year. Everybody was hanging around in the parks all day long. You'd see people working in the parks, people with families. It was actually quite beautiful that in the parks, it was almost like something out of the 19th century. And then, you know, that summer was also the Black Lives Matter protests sort of exploded across the country. And that was very much happening in New York. But it felt like, because Trump was still president, and New York, a lot of New Yorkers felt very abandoned by Trump during the pandemic, where, you know, he was encouraging all sorts of, you know, don't wear masks and all of these things, felt very abandoned. And then the Black Lives Matter movement partly felt like this sort of, I mean, it was about a very specific thing. Of course, it was about state violence against Black people and the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd. But it also felt like we've had enough, like this kind of thing. And there was, as I wrote in the book, there was a strange joy to those protests. They started off kind of rough in New York, but then it really became this thing that was just going on all the time, where, you know, they'd gather at certain places and you saw so many young people doing that. I really feel it energized all these 20-year-olds and even younger people who were otherwise doing remote learning at home. So it was a new civil rights movement. That's, you know, and that felt hopeful in that year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've been talking for a while about your essays in your collection. So I'm hoping you can, before I ask you my final question that I usually ask, if you can kind of read an excerpt from one of these for us.
Sure. Let me just flip to the page of what I think would be a good choice. I'll read you just the opening of the essay called Neighbor. How's that?
Sounds great.
What is it about the word neighbor that fills us with such moral ambivalence? Ah, the age-old dilemma, love thy neighbor or drunkenly urinate on his doorstep at 3 a.m? In the abstract, we use the word neighbor as if it refers to something more than the stranger who happens to live near us. It's the neighborly thing to do, we say of our good deeds, as if moral virtue bubbles up wherever random human beings happen to eat, sleep, and shit in rough proximity. A neighbor is not a relative or a friend, but neighbors are commonly thought to inspire a warm and fuzzy camaraderie, as in Mr. Rogers' creepy invitation, "Won't you be my neighbor?" On the other hand, the word neighbor is also invested with a peculiar paranoia, as in, "What will the neighbors think?" I heard this a lot as a child because we had a lot to hide. It was a function of the social geometry of the suburbs. The inside of the house is for us. The outside is for them, the neighbors. The neighbors got the wash car, the mowed lawn, the friendly wave from across the street. We got the crusty, unwashed dishes, the overflowing stacks of ancient newspapers, the dingy underwear strewn across the furniture. The neighbors got my father leaving for work in a three-piece suit and tie, his face neatly shaven, his keys swinging smartly in his hand as he approached the gleaming car. We got the early performance of my father raging through the house in nothing but a pair of sagging jockey briefs and a single black sock, shouting violent and obscene threats against the other black sock, the missing sock, the stupid goddamn cock-sucking sock, as my mother followed in his wake, hissing, "Lower your voice, the neighbors."
Thank you. So I'm going to ask you one final question on that. What else are you working on? Like, time to promote. So what's new? What do you got going on?
I don't have a specific thing to promote yet. I have been taking notes on new short essays I'd like to write, like Neighbor. Before I wrote Appendix, I had been working on a long essay that was about Natasha and I, about a different chapter of our marriage. And some of that got worked into Appendix. And I have been wondering whether I should try to, because I worked on that for quite a while and there's a lot there. I've been wondering whether I should try to work on that again. The problem is the events that happen there are even more distant than they were when I was first writing it. And the other part is that some of that material wound up in Appendix. So anyway, I would like to mostly work on short things for a little while before I revisit doing a long thing because Appendix was quite an ordeal writing that. I will give a shout out to a magazine I'm associated with, which is Exacting Clam. That is my publisher, Sagging Meniscus. This is their official literary magazine. I'm associated with that magazine as well. I'm on the staff, and it's a great literary magazine. It's always quirky and weird and high quality. So that's currently what's going on.
Well, Tyler, it has been wonderful talking to you about this collection. Tyler Gore, who wrote My Life of Crime, Essays and Other Entertainments. Thanks for talking with me for New Books Network.
Thanks so much, Rebecca. I've really had a great time being here.